Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of April. It was 1 year ago today that the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig exploded over a BP well. It killed 11 workers, and it opened a gusher that spewed some 170 million gallons of toxic crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico. 1 year later, we are asking what reforms have been instituted that would make drilling safer. Our guest this hour is Bill Snape. He is presently senior counsel with the Center for Biological Diversity and a legal fellow and practitioner in residence at the American University Law School. He coordinates the Center for Biological Diversity's legal and policy work on endangered species, wilderness, and energy from Washington, D.C. Did his undergraduate work at the University of California at L.A., law degree from George Washington University, and has written many articles as well as a book on natural resource issues in his 20-year career. He has taught environmental and international law and was with Defenders of Wildlife before joining the center. He also is a swim coach. We like that. Here's our phone number. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Good morning, Bill. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. What reforms have been instituted since last year that would make drilling safer, Bill?
Well, the Department of Interior, which authorizes these offshore oil drilling activities, has begun to implement some of the reforms that industry had identified almost a decade ago. These relate to the blowout preventers that were at issue in the BP disaster and other sort of technical corrections. What they have not done is ensure that our bevy of modern environmental statutes, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and others, are being complied with. So as we sit here today, a year after the disaster, the worst environmental disaster in American history, drilling activity, deep water drilling activity, is occurring in the Gulf of Mexico out of compliance with our environmental laws. It's frankly, outrageous.
How much of that is taking place? Who's doing that kind of drilling?
Well, BP has received a deepwater permit just within the last month. All of the major oil companies have received these deepwater permits. Chevron, I know, has received one. Shell is seeking one in the Arctic Ocean, which would be a disaster if they were to receive that. A couple smaller oil companies. 10 deepwater permits have been issued over the course of the past month. None of them in compliance with these environmental laws.
How in the world can you have that happen, considering what we remember from the last year, what we remember from a year ago today? How in the world can you have that happen?
Well, there's a legal answer to that and a political answer. I'll start with the political answer. The reality is that we are a country addicted to oil, and we are a country that certainly our political processes are beholden to the oil companies. Make no mistake about it, on Capitol Hill and in the White House. It is the oil companies who get the ear of lawmakers, not the general public, not the dolphins, and certainly not disenfranchised people in the area of New Orleans who are eating tainted fish and who are, you know, living and breathing this disaster still every day.
Mm-hmm. I was watching news reports last night, and it was interesting to me how many reports said, well, it's not as bad as we thought it could have been. You know, things are better than we thought they were going to be a year hence.
Well, I think that's spin. I think any serious scientific examination of what occurred and what is still occurring indicates two things that I think are unrebuttable. The first is we're not going to know the full impact of this disaster for another couple of years. In fact, it may be decades until we fully understand the impacts. Remember, with the Exxon Valdez tragedy, which occurred 20 years ago, we are still learning about the negative impacts of that spill. And, of course, that spill was a fraction of what occurred in the Gulf of Mexico. The second issue is that, really, this is spin by the oil companies. And if you look at the fact that dolphins continue to wash ashore dead,
mm-hmm.
migratory birds continue to be found dead, sea turtles continue to be found dead, and in fact, perhaps most importantly, the seafood that people eat is still tainted. I mean, when you look at all of those indicators, we are nowhere near cleaning this up, and we probably won't be anywhere near it for a very long time.
This new agency that we have, this new name, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, instead of the Minerals Management Service, those who run the agency are saying that it will be years before they can establish a robust regulatory regime to minimize the risks to workers and the environment while still allowing exploration offshore. Why is it so darn hard to establish a regulatory regime? Why would it take years?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think it should take that long. And I think part of the problem is, if not the main part of the problem, is that the oil companies are pressuring the administration to move quickly. They are putting a lot of pressure on the White House. The oil state, Democrats and Republicans both, particularly in that region, are really hammering the administration. And so the reason why we can't put together a protective regime and the reason why we're not complying with these environmental statutes is because there's been a political calculation to continue drilling as fast as we can. And I don't think the American public is fully cognizant of that yet. We really do have a case of amnesia going on here.
And what in the world, heaven forbid, would happen if we have another major oil spill in this area?
Well, heaven forbid is right. I think the area would be completely devastated. I mean, that ecosystem, I don't think, could take another spill like that. And, you know, another thing about this spill, aside from the 200 million gallons that was spilled, at least the 200 million gallons, and that's a hard number, I think, for us to wrap our heads. So much oil was spilled. But the other big problem is the dispersants that were applied. These dispersants don't get rid of the oil. They just break the oil down into smaller particles, and the dispersants themselves have been found to be quite toxic, and we put several million gallons of those dispersants into the Gulf of Mexico. So if we have another major spill like the BP disaster, I really do fear for the literal future of the Gulf of Mexico. And I should point out that since the BP disaster, we've had a series of smaller spills. There was just a spill a couple weeks ago of several thousand gallons of oil. So this is an area that continues to suffer, and a lot of it is happening outside the public vision.
You mentioned our dependence on oil, which is huge, which keeps us from moving forward in this area. And we've been having a dependence on oil with dire consequences for years in this country. I've been asking on the air for years the very same question. When do we wake up? When do we find an alternative? When do we at least institute some major conservation program?
Well, that's a great question. And, of course, there are many prongs to answer it. I'll start with a basic premise, which is when you look at all of the great achievements, the truly great achievements this country has taken on over its history, and I'm thinking, for instance, about World War I and World War II, and I'm talking about dealing with tobacco and dealing with civil rights, there was a clear explanation of the sacrifice that needed to occur by the president and by the leaders of Congress. And what we're not seeing right now, and we didn't see it even after the BP disaster, but this was a great opportunity to have a truly educational moment, we're not being told by our leaders, hey, you know what? We know times are tough economically, but we have got to change our ways. We have got to find ways to use less oil, to change the way we transport ourselves, to change the way we live. And it's not going to happen overnight, and there can be some transition assistance, but we've got to change our ways. We didn't hear that from one political leader. We heard that we can have it all. We've heard that $4 a gallon of gasoline is outrageous. Now, that's expensive for some people, and I know people are hurting, but $4 a gallon for gasoline, for instance, this is just by way of example, far less than what the rest of the world pays. So I think that we really are seeing a lack of leadership, and I think one of the reasons we're seeing a lack of leadership is that the very leaders who are supposed to be leading, unfortunately, are beholden to those oil companies. These oil companies are extraordinarily powerful. The money and the influence they can yield, I think, is beyond most people's imagination.
It's amazing. I've been reading some articles about the amount of money that they have dispersed in the Gulf, probably not nearly enough to compensate people for losing their livelihoods, but they've been giving out a lot of money.
That's right.
Exactly. And they've been making their executives a lot of money.
Well, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but Shell's the profits over the last couple quarters have been in the multi-hundred millions, if not billions of dollars. So, yeah, the oil companies continue to do quite well as the people impacted by the spill, of course, are still struggling to survive.
So what is it that we need to do? Let's just start in terms of conservation, and then we'll go into regulatory areas, what needs to be done. What kind of major conservation program do we need to embark on?
Well, you know, it's funny. We don't necessarily need today a major new conservation program. We may need a new program as we deal with these issues. What we've been talking about is just complying with existing law. We've had the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act for 40 years. We know how those statutes work. Let's apply them to the Gulf of Mexico. We know how the Environmental Impact Statement law works, the law that says look before you leap on these types of major projects. Let's comply with that law. And so when the Department of Interior is handing out these deep water permits and handing out these allowances to explore for more oil, they ought to be making the oil companies comply with law. This is not rocket science. This is not radical. Yet it's not happening. And we'd like to have existing law enforced. And I think if that occurred, some of the more dangerous projects, I think, would fall by the wayside because they would probably be unable to comply with the law. And the projects that maybe I don't personally like, but that actually do comply with the law, probably could go forward. And I think that would be a fair way in this transition period to move forward, because we're not going to get off oil tomorrow. Everyone recognizes that. But the only way we're going to allow wind and solar and geothermal and other types of conservation type practices to take hold is if we hold the polluters to existing law. It's not a terribly complicated concept.
And the problem with complying, getting them to comply with the law, is that we don't have enough regulators to make sure they comply with the law, or we don't have any, or they look the other way?
It's a combination of all those things. And I would say ultimately the Department of Interior and the administrations of Republicans and Democrats. This is an instance, by the way, where I'm quite sorry to say it's hard to discern that great a difference between Obama and George W. Bush. They view it as a nuisance, and the political direction has been issue these permits, start the drilling again. And so when middle-level bureaucrats and operatives hear that, they know what the score is, and they start handing out the permits. And so it's really left to private citizens and interest groups such as the Center for Biological Diversity to haul these bad actors into court and say, to both Republican and democratically appointed judges, by the way, who have ruled for us, both of those judges, to say, look, these entities need to comply with the law. So it's a shame that we have to resort to that type of litigation, but ultimately that's the only thing that we have to make sure our laws are being followed.
Bill Snape, our guest this hour. 1 year ago today, the horrendous, worst environmental disaster in history took place in the Gulf, and we're talking about the regulations. It would appear there aren't very many that have been put in place since then to keep this kind of disaster from happening again. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Bill is Senior Counsel, Center for Biological Diversity, and a fellow in environmental law at American University. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls. Craig is next, is our first caller, actually. Hi, Craig.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Taking my call.
Sure.
I know NOAA and countless other colleges, when the oil spill happened, they were out there testing the waters to see how far it would it drifted. Knowing that the current's going, obviously, in and out of the Gulf into the Atlantic, I was wondering, is there anybody mandated to be following how far this is disbursements and the oil and whatever else got pushed out into the water, how far into the Atlantic this is gone?
That's a really good question, Craig. The short answer is I don't think anyone really knows at this point. You're right. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, otherwise known as NOAA, is the federal agency responsible ultimately for those types of studies. And I know some of those studies are going on. There are also many other independent studies by the universities in the southeast part of the United States, University of Georgia, Florida State, LSU. I don't think we have a handle yet on exactly what type of damage occurred outside of the Gulf of Mexico. But you are right. Absolutely, some of those pollutants, the oil, the dispersants, did drift outside the Gulf of Mexico. It was obviously concentrated in the Gulf, most of the damage, but I think that is a subject that needs to be further examined, but I don't know the answer to that today. I'm not sure anyone does. Excellent question, though.
Thanks, Craig, for the call. Wayne from Holman is next. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Good show. I quick question to your guest. When I came back from Nam, I finished my undergraduate work, and I grew up on a farm, and so we purchased my parents' farm. I had to work off the farm for quite a while to make ends meet, but so I'm familiar with 14-hour days working. But my question to your guest is, and he seems reasonable, farmers and truckers, here's what we need. We need hydraulic fluid. We need grease. We need oil. We need diesel fuel and unleaded gas. And I hope that you agree that we're going to have those things for quite a while. And, it's going to be tough if these prices, for example, if gas or unleaded gas gets up into and diesel fuel gets up to $8, $9 a gallon, that's going to really put a squeeze on food production, on trucking. So I guess I'm for drilling. I think we need to quit sending all our money to Saudi Arabia and Venezuela and other places. But, you can't mount a solar panel or a windmill on the hood of our tractors. It just doesn't work. And there aren't enough batteries to pull a one-ton piece of equipment and try to charge up a two-ton tractor. There's an old saying in the country, when the sun shines, you got to make hay. Could I have your comments on that, please? And thank you very much.
Thanks, Wayne.
Wayne, very good question, and I appreciate it. Let me say one thing initially and then get into actually answering your question. The first thing is that the price of gasoline today, the price of gasoline tomorrow, and even for the rest of the year, has nothing to do with the amount of oil that we drill for in the Gulf of Mexico in the foreseeable future. The lag time between the drilling and the price of gasoline is such, and there's so many other intervening factors, including market speculation, that those two issues, while there is a long-term relationship to those things, if we start drilling tomorrow in the Gulf of Mexico, gas prices are not going to go down. So that's the initial point. But I hear you on your larger point, and I do not necessarily disagree with you. In fact, I think I agree with you. And I think the answer really is, whose ox is being gored here? We talked about the oil companies' profits. They continue to be in the hundreds of millions and billions of dollars. I have not yet mentioned, and now is an appropriate time to say, that part of the reason why the oil companies do so well is because they receive millions of dollars of subsidies every year from the federal government. So, one of the ways in which I think we need to deal with this problem, and this is not going to be an easy thing to do, I do not wish to imply that this is a snap of the fingers type of exercise, it is going to be a long-term effort, is to actually tax or charge fees on the carbon that is creating these problems, on the fossil fuels that are creating these problems, and then give a rebate back to the American taxpayer that equals the amount of that carbon tax. Now, what that would do is it would make you whole. It would put an appropriate price on a substance that clearly is damaging our environment. We haven't yet talked about global warming and climate change, but these are all sort of interrelated topics in terms of our fossil fuel addiction. And it would force the oil companies to actually internalize the cost of their goods that we all use, goods that I used, I drove to work today, internalize it in a way where they hold the cards and they hold the cost, not externalizing those costs to the American public and to the public at large the way they're doing it now. So I recognize that there is some short-term pain going on and will continue to go on. I recognize that many, many people cannot afford $8 of gallon of gas when they pump their cars or their trucks, but there are a lot of mechanisms that could be utilized to make sure that the normal taxpayer, the person really slogging it through day in and day out, is not harmed. And the reason why we're not doing that, the reason why we're not doing what every economist or most economists have said would be the right thing to do, this carbon tax idea, is because the fossil fuel companies don't like it. That would change their ability to gouge the taxpayer.
We go to Judy in Wausau. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Judy. This is a hi, folks. This is a good show. I just wanted to ask your guest if he was recently aware of the show Good Morning America doing a large segment on sending Sam Champion, their weatherman, down to the Gulf, showing him eating shrimp, eating fish, and interviewing wildlife experts down there, saying basically that the BP oil spill had no effect and that things were just hunky-dory right now. And that things had cleared up and that the fish was fine, eating was fine, the water was clear. They did a very significant segment on this, and I'm wondering what your guest's opinion on that is.
Well, I did not see that particular Good Morning America segment, and I am not saying that every single shrimp and every single oyster is contaminated, but there are a number of studies on food safety done by groups that focus on food safety that lead me to believe I wouldn't be feeding that food to my children. I have two teenage boys, and in fact, I would be very careful about how much I eat. And I love oysters, and I love shrimp, and I love that area of the country. But to say that we know that all that seafood is healthy, I think belies the fact that there's a reason why dolphins are washing ashore dead right now for reasons that we don't fully understand. There's a reason why sea turtles and birds continue to be found dead. So it can't be that the dolphins and the sea turtles and the birds are dying from the contaminants and somehow the shrimp and the oysters and the other fish are somehow escaping that. That doesn't seem very logical to me. So I agree that it is not a clear-cut issue, but when you just think about the magnitude of the toxic chemicals that were dumped into the Gulf, both with the oil and the dispersants, I certainly would think twice before I bellied up for some oysters down in Cajun country.
It almost makes you want to have pictures of those poor dead dolphins displayed prominently at the breakfast table of everybody who's in a supposedly regulatory capacity, and all of the people who are supposed to be in charge, our president and members of Congress, etc. How can you not look at that and wonder what's wrong?
That's right. And aside from the fact that we love dolphins and dolphins are incredible creatures, you know, if those dolphins are dying, you talk about a canary in the coal mine, and I think this is what you were implying. I mean, what's going on here? There's something serious happening.
We go next. Thanks, you, Judy, very much for the call. We go to Mike next from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning. I have several things here I want to ask. Number one, on this dispersant, the way I understand it, it's basically a detergent. And the reason BP and some others' comments say, oh, everything's going fine, it's clearing up, well, it all sunk to the bottom. And I think BP should devise some sort of a dredge and find out where the masses of this stuff are settling and go and suck it up, dredge it up. And it's sludge, and I'm sorry. It does, I lived around petroleum all of my childhood when my dad worked in it, and this stuff isn't going to break down. I mean, oil don't go away. It's next thing impossible. And also that blowout preventer, the way I'm interpreting this, it's basically electric-operated solenoid valve. They could put two or three tandem on there. If one fails, you got two more down there. They shouldn't just go with one device and improve on that. And also, what would you like? I am a grassroots advocate, and I'm always in contact with the Senate and the Congress, and I would like to know what you think would be a good thing to a good demand on this short and sweet. And the point of the talk shows here is to stimulate the public, and they should be contacting their legislators as well, not just listening to these shows. And then we'll get somewhere.
Bill.
Well, those are both good points and questions. Let me try to take them each in turn. And I agreed with all of your assumptions and all of the factual assertions that you made, so I won't repeat those because I think you were spot on. Three points or three responses. The first is that, as you know, BP is in litigation right now. There are, in addition to the settlement procedures that the administration set up, which actually I think was a good thing to get some money into affected people's hands right away, although there's some discrepancies about who got what. For those who did not opt into that settlement or negotiated type of process. There's hundreds of pieces of litigation going on now from small business owners and individuals and homeowners impacted by the spill. So how much BP pays and exactly what remedial actions BP needs to take, I think, is going to play itself out over the course of the next couple of years. Remember, the Exxon Valdez litigation took 20 years. In fact, somewhat ironically, that the Exxon Valdez litigation was ending just as the disaster last year occurred a year ago today. So litigation is going to deal with some of those issues. The second point I would make is that under federal law, there's a process called the Natural Resource Damage Assessment. And unfortunately, it's not an incredibly transparent process. The public's involved, but usually very late in the process. And the idea behind the Natural Resource Damage Assessment process is to make BP pay to restore the natural resources of that area. Now, part of the problem with assessing that type of calculation is that we don't really have the best baseline information as to exactly what the Gulf was like the moment before the well blew up. So there's going to be some estimates, and in fact, I think the federal government has not been quite as aggressive as it should be in trying to really understand the extent of the damage. But it's still a good process, and it's certainly better than nothing. And so you'll hear about that process, the Natural Resource Damage Assessment process, over the coming months and years. And that leads me to my third point, which I think was really your main question. I have a friend who's been doing environmental advocacy for a long time and, in fact, ran for Congress and has done all sorts of interesting things in his life. And he has a saying. It's called endless pressure, endlessly applied. And, political advocacy, small p political advocacy, I'm not talking about Republicans and Democrats. I'm talking about people protecting their interests and people having the system work for them. It's a hard job. Mm-hmm. It's a slog. It is depressing at times. It is tiresome at times. But the only way in which members of Congress are going to understand that you and I and everyone else want a fair shake is to hear from you. And it means you do have to take some time and write a letter, take a time and make a visit, take a time and make a phone call, take some time and inform friends. Because the only way we're going to make an impact is to have that type of constant, endless pressure, endlessly applied. But I don't want to be Pollyanna-like. It's not going to happen overnight. But perhaps the disaster of the BP spill will catalyze us, and the ongoing specter of climate change, for that matter, will catalyze us all to come together and be better stewards. And I should say a little bit of self-promotion, but I think it's good self-promotion, that at the Center for Biological Diversity, we have instituted a program called the Clean Air Advocates, and we have 7,000 activists around the country, and I urge you to join us, by the way, at www.biologicaldiversity.org, where we are doing just that. We are, in state by state, organizing people who come to us and having them meet with Senator Cole from Wisconsin, or Senator Landrieu from Louisiana, or Senator Feinstein from California. And what we are finding is that it's making a difference. It doesn't happen overnight, but when you consistently go in and talk to these senators and talk to their staff and they know that you're out there, all of a sudden they begin to realize, wait a minute, this isn't just about the oil companies. And they're starting to read letters to the editor in the newspaper. They're starting to understand that there's a sentiment different than what BP is telling them.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment about the bills. The House evidently is considering three bills now that would force this new agency or old agency or combination thereof to move more quickly on drilling permits, to open vast new areas along the Atlantic and the Pacific coast to drilling, to reopen lease sales that had been canceled after the Deepwater Horizon. A separate bill would ease environmental rules for drilling off the shores of Alaska. What's the status of those bills? Do you think that those are all going to go through and not be vetoed or not be stopped by the Senate?
The larger dynamic going on in Congress right now is, and by the way, I should point out before I even get into this, that I come from a family of Republicans. I'm an independent registered voter. So I, Richard Nixon, a Republican, signed a lot of these statutes. So I view environmental protection to be a not only a bipartisan, but a nonpartisan issue. But that being said, this new House Republican majority is beyond the pale. I, in my 25 years of doing this work, I've never seen a group that is as less educated and more ideological than the current House Republican majority. They operate on a factual premise that is literally in la-la land many times. And so it's really difficult to discern exactly what to do with them. And, in fact, I think what you're seeing is that the Senate, which is pretty closely divided, Republicans and Democrats, is going to call a lot of these shots because even Republicans in the Senate are recognizing that these proposals coming out of the House are just not palatable. They're not realistic. They're not good policy, and in fact, going to take the country and probably the Republican Party right down the toilet. So I don't think any of these really extreme measures in the House are going to pass, but they do shape the public debate, and they do shape the way in which things are talked about. And I think that's part of the problem right now is that the drill baby drill crowd is still as strong and virulent as it has ever been. And so far, we have not seen from President Obama a clear indication on how he's going to deal with that force. In fact, he seems to capitulate to it at times. So I don't think that the House Republican proposals are all going to be passed. But as the metaphor goes, when you throw a bucket of spaghetti up on the ceiling, a couple strands stick, and that's the concern, is that the House Republican majority will propose so many bad things that one or two they'll get just because of the way the process works. And I think that's what we need to be careful of.
Randy and Kokana. Hi, Randy.
Great topic, great guest. And I think this dovetails right into what your guest was just talking about. You keep hearing the mantra, drill, baby, drill. And my comment and question is, well, let's say that we open up more drilling in the Anwar and off the Atlantic coast and in the Gulf. But then again, let's say that I'm a U.S. oil company. Why would I sell all of my oil back into the U.S. at a lower price? Why would I not put all of my oil out there on the world market? Nobody's ever addressed that, and I got a feeling that it doesn't matter how much we drill in the U.S. It's not going to help one iota's worth when it comes to getting prices adjusted. If anything, I think maybe we've got a shortage of refinery capacity.
Well, that is a really good point and question, and I agree with it. And all I can really add to it is that, and I was alluding to this before, but you give me the opportunity to expound upon it, is that the price of gasoline, and even, frankly, the price of an oil barrel, is dictated in the short term and even in the medium term by forces that have little to do with availability and a lot to do with speculation and quarterly profits by these corporations. And so most people, of course, when you get into that type of complex international economics, don't quite understand that. All they see is they're paying more at the gas pump and they don't have a lot of money and they're hurting. And so they're susceptible to the argument that somehow if we start drilling tomorrow, the gas prices will go down the next day, which, of course, is fallacious. So I do think that market speculation and the ways in which the oil companies do control the prices in ways that most people don't acknowledge, I think, is a huge issue. And I think your points are, again, spot on.
Let's go to an email. Somebody who mentioned blowout preventers, remote control systems that can be put on oil rigs so if there's a leak, it can be remotely sealed. Brazil and Norway both require them. Back in 2005 or 2006, the U.S. government was looking into this, but the oil lobbyists, according to this caller, got it killed. The caller wants to know why the U.S. media isn't covering this, finding out who voted against it.
Again, another good question. The issue of voting against the really state-of-the-art blowout preventers never really occurred in Congress. Congress has yet to do really anything as it relates to the BP disaster, which itself is really amazing when you think about it. Hasn't dealt with the liability caps that the oil industry gets. Hasn't addressed the safety issues that the emailer is talking about. So these types of safety techniques are dealt with at the administrative level by the Department of Interior, which is the agency in charge of this. And the Department of Interior, according to its own inspector general, its own independent auditing office within the agency, has repeatedly said that the Department of Interior is hostage to the oil company, that what used to be called Minerals Management Service, now called BOMRE, or we like to call it BUMR, is beholden to the oil industry. And so the reason why these types of very common sense precautions were not taken is because the oil companies didn't want to deal with them. These, as I alluded to before, some of these provisions and some of these safety measures had been identified as early as 2001 and 2002. We have the records to prove it because this deepwater drilling is relatively new and, of course, extremely risky when you talk about the water pressure. So, again, I think the issue of why we haven't adopted these safety measures goes right back to the political power that these companies wield.
Yeah. The Times had, well, everybody's had some interesting articles, but the Times had an interesting piece. At least we have done this. Rig inspectors, they say, are trying to adopt a more professional stance and no longer accept free transportation and meals from the rig operators. They are bringing their own lunches when they make visits.
And no more free Super Bowl tickets. And you know, I have to say, because this is, it's all, you can easily research this. It is absolute fact that in the Bush administration, the agency supervising the oil companies was literally found in bed with the oil company. They were having sex parties, drug parties, all right on the federal taxpayers' tab. I mean, really incredible stuff that you'd think what Hollywood create was actually happening. So yes, this is a relationship that is quite sordid and needs to be fixed. And I still think it's not fixed. We've taken some baby steps, but we still haven't fixed it. And I do want to say one other point before I forget it and I don't have a chance to address it.
Sure.
The deep water drilling, as the previous speaker questioner was alluding to, occurs all over the world, and in every instance, whether it be Nigeria, whether it be Australia, whether it be Brazil. Even if those safety precautions are in place, these oil spills are occurring all over the world and having disastrous impacts for the people in those areas. This is not a problem just centered upon the Gulf of Mexico. And in fact, if you want to read just absolutely depressing stories, read about what has been going on in Nigeria over the course of the last decade with some of these drilling practices. I mean, you've got just local communities and people devastated by the fact that their local drinking water supplies now are ruined. Nigeria is a just absolute poster child for what can go wrong when the oil companies reach their final fruition of power.
Don in Madison, hi.
Oh, good morning. There is one bright spot that is strange, that as I understand from news reports, the demilitarized zone between the two Koreas as now a place where there's been a resurgence of flora and fauna. I heard that the cranes there, the very rare ones, are nesting, raising young. It's about 2 miles wide. Humans don't go in it. It's a dangerous place for humans, but not for natural of other kinds of life. Non-human flora, fauna, doing quite well. Maybe that's what it takes.
Well, you know, that raises a couple points, and one sort of tangential point I want to make in response to that is that some of the most incredible natural amenities our country possesses occur on Department of Defense lands. Department of Defense owns a lot of lands in the United States, and many of those areas, because the fact that humans or the general public cannot go on them, have an incredible array of flora and fauna. So, yes, I think your general point is well taken, that sometimes nature can spring up in places if it's just given a chance. I think the problem with taking that analogy or that principle to the Gulf of Mexico is that the Gulf of Mexico has just suffered so many injuries. It really has become an industrial wasteland of sorts for the United States. All of our agricultural pollution flows down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. We have all these different oil spills. So absolutely, the Gulf of Mexico is still a special place. It still has an array of wildlife. It's still a place where humans want to go and hang out at the beach and enjoy what is really an incredibly beautiful place. I love the Gulf of Mexico, but until we stop the damaging activity in the Gulf of Mexico, i.e. the oil drilling, I fear that species like bluefin tuna, an incredible species, could go extinct. Seahorses, oysters may no longer really be a viable species. Now, I mean, I'm worried that we're at the tipping point. I worry that there's only so much of this injury the ecosystem can take, and I think that's a reason why dead dolphins are washing ashore. So I think that we need not only to leave the Gulf of Mexico alone, I think we really need to try to actively restore it at this point.
Don, thanks for the call. More phone calls in a moment. It was 1 year ago today that the BP oil disaster took place, and we're this hour talking about whether or not there are regulations already in place that are just not being reinforced. What's the status of deep water drilling in the Gulf right now, and plans to go to do deep water drilling along the coast and Alaska? And welcoming your phone calls. Our guest is Bill Snape. He is senior counsel at the Center for Biological Diversity and a fellow in environmental law at American University. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have a few more emails we want to get to as well, and that address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Wednesday, the author of Morning, Noon, and Night, Finding the Meaning of Life Stages, Arnold Weinstein, will be our guest. He's been a professor of comparative literature at Brown for some 40 years, and we're going to talk about literature as a mirror, how we use it to understand our initial entry into the world and our exit from it. So we'll be examining great works of literature, hour number two of the program. Linda is our next caller. Hi, Linda. Linda, are you there from Bristol? Sorry, Linda is not. So we go next to Mark from Oregon. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to point out the irony and hypocrisy in the Republican position on this, because on one hand, when it comes to the budget, they want to slash everything and not, quote-unquote, kick the can down the road. But in terms of energy policy, they're more than willing to, you know, put our environment at risk and drill for a finite resource rather than address the long-term energy problems that we have. And I'd like to hear your comment.
Well, that's you're pitching me a softball on that. I agree. And you know, I want to add the additional point that, and thank you for that comment, that many of these subsidies I was talking about, in fact, all of the subsidies I was talking about that the oil and gas companies get, and we can talk about how they get those subsidies in a second, to eliminate them would help the budget deficit. And in fact, one could very forcefully argue that all these many wars that we're involved in overseas are very much related to this same issue. And so you can add on to the tab by billions of dollars a day to the deficit because of our addiction to oil and our unwillingness to not be beholden to the oil companies. The way in which these subsidies work, it's probably a good thing to explain to the audience. A lot of the permits that are issued to the oil companies are very frequently issued for virtually free. The royalties that they have to pay are well below market value, and in fact well below what is even charged sometimes on land. And a lot of the transport and infrastructure system is created and built by the federal government, not by the oil companies. So if you eliminate that, you make the oil companies compete on the same playing field that all other energy sources do. Again, it won't happen overnight, but I think you'll begin to see other sources of energy be able to play a little bit more competitively. But you got to remember, we've been addicted to fossil fuels, or using fossil fuels. I think the addiction occurred just within the last several decades, but we've been using fossil fuel for a century. So that's the old established guard. That's the change that needs to take place. And the Chevrons and the BPs and the Shells and the American Petroleum Institute, they have such power on Capitol Hill. And so until you crack that edifice, we're going to continue to see the type of hypocrisy you mentioned.
When you mentioned the royalties, low as they may be, that may be the case, but are they, considering the fact that we're going through rough financial times, an absolutely crucial part of revenue for the government?
Yes, and I do want, you know, I'm pretty critical of the president sometimes, and I've alluded to that here. This is one area where I think the president, in his State of the Union address, really did have it correct. Although at this point it's only been rhetoric, it hasn't been action yet. But the president has identified these oil and gas fossil fuel subsidies, and we should throw in coal, by the way, while we're at it. I know coal is not mined in the Gulf of Mexico, but it's sort of a part of the big bad trio of oil, gas, coal. He would like, I think, to get a handle on those subsidies, at least rhetorically. And so I think the question is, who's going to do the heavy lifting, who's going to explain to the American public why that needs to occur. So at this point, the president has given a good speech, but we haven't seen a lot of action on that point yet. But we like his platform. I think his platform makes intellectual sense.
Here's an email that's come in from Dennis in Green Bay. I think the nuclear disaster in Japan dumping nuclear waste in the ocean is being underreported, just as the long-term effects of the Gulf oil spill over the last year. People believe if they don't hear about the disaster, it must have gone away.
Well, I agree with that as well. I mean, that Japan disaster is just heartbreaking. And of course, we've seen that in the United States, and we've seen it with Chernobyl. Talk about another industry, the nuclear industry, that gets a lot of subsidies. People don't realize that to even build a nuclear plant in the United States, you need billions of dollars of subsidies, and then they get a liability cap. So if that same disaster were to occur in the United States, what occurred in Japan, the nuclear company at issue would not have to pay the full damages of the leak, but would be limited by what's an act called the Price-Anderson Act. Again, let's make nuclear compete with the other renewable industries. And when you do that, no one wants to touch it. It's only when you throw billions of dollars at it that it can actually compete. And, you know, aside from accidents in nuclear power, which is obvious when you look at the Japan issue, what do you do with the nuclear waste? It still has not been solved. And I think that's why we have that big fight in Yucca Mountain, Nevada, because no one wants to live near nuclear waste. I sure wouldn't. It's extremely dangerous. And that's beyond NIMBY or not in my backyard. That's about protecting your backyard. So, yes, I agree. Nuclear power is not the answer. It's a false panacea.
Reed in Clintonville. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Say, first off, thank you very much for a rational and realistic Republican addressing issues of great concern for our country. Initially, I wanted to say that oil at $18 a barrel approximate for production for an oil company, they should be subsidizing the rest of us in this country with realistic taxes on their behalf. I'm very concerned about the fact that they're crying for more oil leases when there are hundreds, perhaps thousands, of oil leases already cashed in their drawers, and yet they have not acted upon them. And it appears to me as if there, if not active collusion, there's certainly tacit or passive collusion on behalf of very ultra-conservative Republican and Tea Party members with the oil companies to increase the number of leases by causing this severe crisis. And thank you. I'll hang up.
Thanks,
and
Reed.
Your answer.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah. I agree with that premise and the facts you stated. And just to repeat the central fact you were making for the listening audience. Many of the existing permits and leases that have already been granted by the federal government, both offshore and onshore, haven't even been utilized by the oil companies, and then they go out and look for more. So you're absolutely right that dynamic occurs. In addition to the collusion that you referenced, and I am sure that there is some of that, I think part of it is also just chaos, because there's so many of these projects that are going on. I don't think the regulators and even the oil companies themselves can keep track of it. It becomes just sort of this frenzied party, you know, people just at the trough trying to suck up as much oil as they can. Let me give you an example of how absurd it can sometimes become. In the months preceding the BP disaster, when presumably the Department of Interior was doing its environmental reviews, there were environmental reviews. If it weren't so sad, it would be funny. There were environmental reviews in the Gulf of Mexico, purportedly, talking about walruses and polar bears and seals. And there are no walruses and polar bears and seals in the Gulf of Mexico. What the agency had done is they had literally cut and paste an analysis in Alaska and inserted it into an environmental review document in the Gulf of Mexico. And they passed that off as an environmental review. Now, that's not collusion. That's just stupidity. But it's stupidity that led to the disaster at hand. So I think it is a lot of this is purposeful. A lot of this is sort of bad acting, you know, very intentional bad acting. And some of it is just bad acting based on negligence and carelessness. Mm. It's a combination. And I think that's why I started with the theme that I'm now going to end with, which is let's just follow existing environmental law. These are not statutes that are complicated. These are not statutes we don't know how to operate. Let's comply with existing law and see which of the projects actually can make the grade that way.
We have about 45 seconds. Mike from Reedsburg, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay.
Bill, I just wanted to point out a few things here. That
you'll have to make it one. We're almost out of time.
Okay. I am a daily oil trader slash speculator, also a human being who cares about the environment. I just wanted to point out that all the regulations and all of the insurance companies and reinsurance companies are seeing much higher risk. So that goes also to the oil companies into the production of oil. I also wanted to make a comment about Wayne when he was saying, I don't know if it was Wayne, but the other comment about we don't have very many refiners, that is not true. We have more refining capability than most people know, and our daily diesel fuel production actually is being shipped offshore to emerging markets.
All right, we need to hold you there. We have a very few seconds here. Bill?
Yeah, very quick response. I think that's a valid point, and I would agree that some of the risk of these operations has begun to trickle to the oil companies, but I think they're baby steps, and I'm very worried that we don't continue in that trend and in fact, revert to the amnesia I was talking about before. So I think what we need to do is have that risk firmly in the laps of the oil companies, not in the general public's
lap. Thank you, Bill, so much. You were a wonderful guest for this day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill is a senior counsel at the Center for Biological Diversity, a fellow in environmental law at American University. Bill Snape, our guest. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We'll return following the news.